Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and if you're ready, we'll begin.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. We start with that blown undercover operation in Yemen intended to rescue American photojournalist Luke Summers. It resulted not only in his death, but the death of a South African hostage due to be released over the weekend. President Obama deployed Navy SEAL Team 6 because, according to U.S. officials, hostage Summers was in imminent danger. But the rescue attempt ended in gunfire, and U.S. officials say they were not aware that South African Pierre Corky's negotiated release from al-Qaeda custody was also imminent. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel did not seem to express many misgivings about the events leading up to the raid when he spoke to reporters in Afghanistan.
I don't think it's a matter of going back and having a review of our process. Our process is about as thorough as there can be. Is it imperfect? Yes. Is there risk? Yes. But we start with the fact that we have an American that's being held hostage, and that American's life is in danger. That's where we start. And then we proceed from there.
Joining us now with more details on this operation is Rukmini Callimachi, foreign correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me, John.
What seems to have gone wrong in this operation? And it certainly seems as though the U.S. was ready with something of a hair trigger to go into Yemen in any case.
What we know from what has been reported and what U.S. officials have said is that in the final minutes before this raid began, someone seems to have alerted the kidnappers. We don't know if it was a dog barking or if it was a rustling that they heard. And immediately a firefight began. And the element of surprise that they thought they had, which is essential in any of these raids, was gone. Al-Qaeda essentially has a protocol, which is that if they believe a rescue mission is in progress, their instructions are to immediately kill the hostages. And so that's what they did. They executed Summers, the American hostage, and very tragically, they also killed the South African hostage, who was literally hours away from being released.
So if you know this al-Qaeda protocol, presumably the Navy SEALs would have known this protocol as well. And so any breach of the surprise of the undercover at any moment would have been disastrous.
I think the calculation they were making is that al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula released a video a couple of days ago giving a three-day deadline for Luke Summers, for his life. They gave the United States 3 days to meet their demands. We still don't know what those demands were, or they said they would kill him. That deadline was due to expire on Saturday, and although I don't know this as fact, U.S. officials made the calculation that they did not want to see, you know, another American hostage killed in a gruesome way on a videotape, which would play on national television. So the thought was that they needed to do something right away. It's just terrible luck and very tragic that failed mission, in addition to killing the hostage that it was trying to save, also killed a South African captive who was just about to be released.
And that compounds the tragedy. Was the U.S. aware of Mr. Corky, the South African individual whose release, as you say, was imminent?
U.S. officials have said that they had no indication about his release, that it was imminent. And they've also said that they did not know that he was being held in the same location as Mr. Summers. I'm still researching that latter point because on November 25th, when there was the first raid to try to save Luke Summers, remember, this is the second of two raids, there was a lot of reporting on the fact that although several hostages were saved, that Luke and several others were moved. And in that reporting, there was mention of the fact that a British and a South African hostage were believed to have been with Luke Summers. Now, this is just out there in the general, you know, reporting sphere. Whether U.S. officials, you know, were aware of that or not is hard to pinpoint. What seems clear is that they really did not know that negotiations had concluded for him, and that Gift of the Givers, a South African charity which was leading those negotiations, had gotten the kidnappers to agree to release him essentially on Sunday in return for a $200,000 ransom. I interviewed the director of this charity, and he explained to me that look, they never thought to contact the Americans. It never occurred to them that this sort of scenario could occur. And they had been told by the kidnappers to keep everything confidential.
Can you remind Americans or listeners in any case just the extent of the involvement of the U.S. military in the operations in Yemen using drones and these kinds of covert operations and attempts to rescue hostages?
Well, the United States has had, in recent years, quite a large footprint in Yemen in terms of the aerial surveillance, the drones that they've been using. This military raid is somewhat unique. And a part of the tragedy here is that AQAP, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which is the group that we know is holding him, they have a history of, they've held many hostages. And this is the first hostage that I know of that's been executed, or these two. This is a business for them. They've been doing this since at least 2012, possibly 2011. And every other hostage, you know, from Swiss citizens to a Finnish couple to an Austrian man, they've all gotten out after their governments or intermediaries negotiated with the kidnappers, usually in return for ransom.
Rukmini Kalamaki is a foreign correspondent for our partner, The New York Times, speaking to us from Istanbul, Turkey. Thank you so much, Rukmini.
Thank you, John, for having me.
President Obama has set out to use his bully pulpit to address the police tactics that resulted in the deaths of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, and Eric Garner in New York.
Too many Americans feel deep unfairness when it comes to the gap between our professed ideals and how laws are applied on a day-to-day basis.
President speaking last week and responding to protests that followed the decision not to indict police who tried to arrest Eric Garner and ended up killing him instead. The president was also addressing the anger and violence that erupted after Ferguson's no indictment decision. Violent demonstrations continued for a second day in Berkeley, California. A presidential task force on 21st century policing has been formed to study local departments' tactics and to make recommendations to improve community trust in the next 90 days. Philadelphia Police Commissioner Charles Ramsey is co-chair of that task force. He joins us now. Commissioner Ramsey, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
What can a federal commission do to, or task force, or whatever you want to call it, do to increase trust in the local sort of street-to-street areas of places like Staten Island and Ferguson, Missouri?
Well, the president, who takes this issue very, very seriously, decided to put together a task force, and I was honored to be selected as a co-chair for that, to take a look at various aspects of policing to make recommendations for improvement, such as building trust or even establishing trust in many of our communities. You know, we've been at community policing for the last 20, 25 years, but obviously there are some communities that have been left behind, and they tend to be communities of color, communities that are hard-pressed with crime and violence in their neighborhoods. And we've got to find a way to reach that population. We'll also take a look at training and education of police officers, use of force policies, the use of technology, and leadership at all levels within police organizations. So we have 90 days, which isn't a lot of time, to make recommendations for further review and implementation.
Gut level reaction, what did you think was a possible recommendation as you watched things unfold last week and in the wake of what happened in Ferguson? What came to mind immediately to you?
Well, obviously, there is a breakdown in terms of trust. I mean, I think what you saw in both Ferguson and also New York really speaks to the level of trust, not just of police, but of this criminal justice system. And we've got to listen. And we've got to hear what's being said. We need to take a deep dive, a deep look at it to find out what, if anything, we can do to make adjustments so that we can regain trust in the system. People just feel as if they're not going to get a fair shake once something occurs and it goes through the system, including grand juries and so forth.
Right, right. Deep dive, improve the situation of trust. These are the words that the president used to a certain extent. But I mean, more specifically, would you expect, for instance, the New York Police Department to be sued because of what happened to Eric Garner? There is a expected $75 million wrongful death suit that is threatened. What would you expect?
Well, I mean, people have a right to file lawsuits, and that's something that might occur, might not occur. I'm not an attorney. I don't have that much knowledge as it relates to that specific case. I would not be surprised should one be filed, but I have no inside knowledge as to whether or not one would be filed or not.
Is there anything of your recommendations that would be mandatory from whatever it is that you come up with in the next 90 days?
Well, part of what we have to do is figure out how it's implemented. The easy part is coming up with recommendations. The more difficult part is always implementation. And that's something we'll have to discuss as we move forward with this process. It's just getting underway. It's only been a little more than a week since the president made the announcement. So we're still in the stages of putting together other members of the task force, laying out exactly what it is we're going to do so that we can meet the time frame that's been given to us. So, but that will be part of our discussions.
Right.
How do we implement?
It's my understanding, Commissioner Ramsey, though, that in legal terms, it's probably going to be voluntary. And I'm wondering, what would be the motivation of a local police chief to take a recommendation from your commission, particularly from you, based on your experience in D.C. during 2000 and the World Bank protests, which were violently put down, and there were millions of dollars in damages paid out against the department?
Well, first of all, they weren't violently put down. There was no tear gas used. There was absolutely nothing that I think would justify the statement they were violently put down. Was there a lawsuit? Yes, there was a lawsuit, particularly the 2002 protests that took place in Pershing Park. What we did was not give people the warnings that was required through our own manuals. It was not a legal requirement in D.C. at the time, and we failed to do that, and we acknowledged that we made an error. The other thing we did not do is make sure that everyone was taken out of the park prior to the group being brought in that was to be arrested. Again, another tactical error on our part, and we've admitted that, and it's still being processed in court, although there were some settlements, but it was not violently put down. That is absolutely not true.
So you claim you've learned lessons from the situation in D.C. What about lessons learned in Philadelphia, where there have been similar charges and lawsuits filed against police tactics, particularly stop and frisk and the kinds of tactics that we saw in the Errol Garner video, where police take someone who doesn't appear to be violating the law in any egregious way and really cracks down on them?
Well, I mean, the cities across the United States have had lawsuits filed around stop, question, and frisk. We entered into an agreement to allow for the review of our forms that we make out as a result of any pedestrian or vehicle stop to make sure that officers are articulating the rationale for the stop, the reasonable suspicion they need for the stop, in order to be able to improve that area. But the bottom line is police officers need to be able to respond to calls for service. We need to be able to stop people who are acting in a suspicious manner and we believe may have committed the crime. And so, you know, but we have to figure out a way of doing it and make sure that we do it in a way in which we aren't violating anyone's rights.
Based on the video of the Eric Garner case, do you think that was an appropriate call to action on the part of the police?
Well, I'm not going to get into the all the specifics. I don't have the grand jury information in that particular case. The grand jury saw more than just the video that's been shown over and over again on television. There was a lot more information presented to the group of civilians who comprise the grand jury, and that's what they based their decision on. I've not seen everything
right
that they saw.
Charles Ramsey is a Philadelphia police commissioner, co-chair of President Obama's 21st Century Task Force on Policing, tasked to improve trust in communities between police and citizens. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. In 1999, music stopped being hardware like CDs, vinyl records, tapes, or printed music, and reverted back to what it had always been anyway, software, an audio experience of a musical code. Napster, the file-sharing program, meant that with just a few clicks, one could listen to virtually any recorded music without paying a dime.
How many MP3s do you have on your computer?
About 600.
Maybe like 100 or something?
6 or 7,000.
Napster.
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 It's called file sharing, seen by some as the wave of the future.
File sharing of MP3 files and other digital formats dodged the $18 price for a CD album and threatened the profligate wealth of the record industry. Billions of dollars in revenue vanished overnight, a
as consumers got used to the idea of free music. The Recording Industry Artists Association says that revenues have fallen more than 40% from their peak in 1999. The story of business, culture, and copyrights is the subject of this week's Retro Report. And Lagan Siebert, producer for Retro Report, is here. Welcome.
Thank you.
So how did Napster get started?
Well, Napster was started by a teenage programmer, Sean Fanning, and just had this idea that he thought that people should be able to share music digitally.
And it changed the experience of being a professional musician forever. Many years later, Robert Ellis describes how he's gone from being a recording artist to really pretty much touring all the time.
In the last few years, we've been on the road pretty much nonstop. I think we did 290-something days last year. I would say touring represents probably 100% of my income. When I was a kid, if I had told myself what I was doing now, I would think that I'd be making a lot more money than I am, yeah.
So what is the impact on musicians like Robert Ellis and many others who have complained about Napster and actually went to court?
For a lot of artists, the net impact has hurt their bottom lines. For someone like Robert Ellis, he really doesn't have much album sales at all. One of the things that Ali Aidar, one of the people we spoke to for the story, who was one of the original programmers for Napster, talked about is that during those early days, they thought that the industry would eventually embrace Napster, because it would help bring the artists and their fans closer together. Because through digital distribution, you can reach your fans directly. You can have conversations with your fans. And that has happened. For every Robert Ellis story, there's also stories of artists like Macklemore, who rose to fame through social media without the help of a record label.
Do you buy recorded music?
I buy recorded music. I grew up I went to college in 99 when Napster first came out. And so I was kind of in that perfect demographic. And in high school, I would say I spent pretty much all of my disposable income on music. And when Napster came out, I was definitely one of those people who said, oh my gosh, I can't believe I can search for literally anything, music that I couldn't find in a store, music that wasn't in Tower Records. I definitely downloaded my fair share of music on Napster.
What brought you back to paying?
Well, both of my parents are singer-songwriters. So there came a time where I, when you stopped and thought about it for a second, you have to realize that it's definitely not sustainable. I mean, that said, it's much easier these days to not pay for music.
It's a totally new world, that's for sure. Retro Report tells the story. Lagan Siebert is a Retro Report producer telling the story of how Napster in 1999 changed the music forever. Thanks.
Thank you.
So what was the last piece of music you've paid for?
I buy CDs for bands I have an affinity for. I know that my generation downloads, which I am no exception. However, my favorite artists I still support by buying their music.
Hi, this is Ryan McLaughlin from Seattle. And even though I paid nothing for it, the U2 album on my iPhone cost me a little bit of something every time it accidentally plays.
U2, paying the price of U2. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Now, here is an artist whose manner of getting paid and getting noticed has completely changed with the advent of social media.
I wouldn't kill to win a war. I don't get what they do it for. It's also terribly vague. I see the pictures from a thousand years of battle, and I think it's such a bore.
Amanda Palmer is the lead singer of the Dresden Dolls. She's an author and entrepreneur and has used Kickstarter and the viral clout of a successful TED Talk to raise money and her profile. Her new book is called The Art of Asking, How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Let People Help. It is not a guide for someone simply trying to pick up a few bucks playing in the subway. Amanda Palmer, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi.
So you've chronicled the cultural shift that's taken place in the music business, and it's something you've actually lived. What would you say is the lesson of the art of asking?
Oh, God. I mean, I think the most important lesson I learned, even while writing the book, having lived it for so many years, is that we don't really view art as a relationship anymore. I think we've kind of gotten lost in the idea of art as a commodity, and we've sort of lost sight of the fact that the artists and the audience are really in a fundamental relationship.
Well, it seems like maybe we haven't lost it so much as found it again, and that's what this transformation is really all about. Describe your surprise at being successful on Kickstarter, or were you even surprised?
Yeah, that's actually a common misconception about my Kickstarter. Because of the way Kickstarter is formatted, there's a minimum that you have to set when you're funding. And I set my Kickstarter minimum at $100,000 and then raised $1.2 million, which I think made everyone assume that I must be just like not only shocked and surprised, but also like swimming in pools of $100 bills. Neither were true. I set my minimum at $100,000 because my team and I calculated the numbers and how much I'd been able to sell directly to my fan base before, and we knew that we could probably raise at least $100,000. We hoped that we would make a lot more. And then the second thing was that I actually made a huge profit. I actually didn't, and that's kind of my dirty Kickstarter secret. I mean, I did choose really expensive packaging, and I offered some bizarre rewards. You know, I flew to fans' houses all over the world. I think a lot of people still don't totally understand that crowdfunding, when you see that number, that giant number on the screen, that's a gross and it's simple business. And then, you know, whatever you wind up with as the net is your choice as the artist or your downfall as a business person.
Well, one of the preconceived notions that remains in the recording industry is that if you make money, you're the bad guy. And there have been lots of stories of you collaborating with musicians and not paying them and that sort of thing. And it's an expensive business.
Yeah, it's another strange thing about our relationship with artists is, you know, Elizabeth Gilbert talks about this in her TED Talk, that in this kind of sadistic way, we feel like our artists and that we as artists should suffer. You know, we don't assess our musicians and our artists and our creative creators the way we assess our tech people and our bakers and our plumbers and our shoemakers. We kind of have a weird double standard.
But you do want to make money, and the Kickstarter success is a promise that you do have to deliver on in terms of a good album, and your fans will tell you one way or another, yes?
Absolutely. I mean, the other thing that you're starting to see in this crazy new music economy, as everyone is scrambling around trying to figure it out, is not only are musicians forced to be their own business people, but the curtain's also being drawn back on the fact that a lot of us already have been. But because of social networking and blogging and, you know, the way the press works nowadays, we're just a lot closer to those facts. That being an artist is a bizarre, multifaceted job, a lot of which includes going to the post office and crunching numbers and scaring up work. And I think that notion bugs a lot of people because of our romanticism around what an artist should be doing with their time. And that can be a little unnerving as a working artist.
Have you actually stopped worrying?
No, not even a little. But I wrote a book about it.
That's right. Amanda Palmer is the lead singer of the Dresden Dolls. She's the author of the book, The Art of Asking, How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Let People Help. Thanks so much, Amanda.
You're so welcome.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
In the first 24 hours after the Ferguson grand jury decided not to indict, Facebook exploded with more than 11 million relevant posts. Add in the responses to the Eric Garner case, and some reports estimate that this conversation has been in the top 10 events on Facebook of all time, a giant national town meeting online. But some Facebook users have noticed that their pages have been infected by what you might call an app that outs racism among your friends. Some people's comments haven't seemed like friends at all, in fact. Here's sports commentator and familiar Takeaway voice, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen.
I have a lot of white men on my Facebook feed that feel justified in telling black people how to react to murders by police and who also vehemently defend the officers' actions. On their own pages, they have some of the most vile and racist posts and propaganda. I went to school with some of these individuals, and as such, they are part of the tapestry of my life and community. I will not erase them from my feed. If you are my friend and want to know how pervasive the ignorance is amongst white men in this country, I suggest you read some of the things they are posting. Seriously, though, what are they so angry about?
That's Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, sports commentator, talking about what's happened on his Facebook page. New Tech City podcast host Manoush Zomorodi has taken a look at this explosion of speech and how people are reacting to it. Manoush, welcome.
Great to be here, John.
So is Ibrahim saying, I want people to see this, or is he erasing his friends and wishing that they hadn't put those comments down there? He's emotionally ambivalent here.
Exactly. And I think that that's the question a lot of people have is, like, how do you deal with something like that? Do you just erase those people, unfriend them, take yourself out of the conversation, say, I will not engage? Or do you sort of try to talk to them, make sense with them? You know, it's very rare, our social psychologists know this, to win an argument on Facebook or anywhere else. People just sort of buckle down and stay with their point of view. So that's really tough for Ibrahim. I mean, some of these comments, at best, they come across as insensitive, at worst, completely racist. So here's another one that Ibrahim told me about.
There's a classic comment that has come up in a lot of different places from mostly white members on my Facebook feed that says, well, more black people kill black people than white people kill black people. On that day, my emotions with that were just, it just broke my heart.
And John, another listener, we've gotten a lot of listener responses because we're working on this episode. Jason Gonzalez, he wrote us about a Facebook discussion on race that started sort of fine and then devolved into really tasteless memes being posted. And he made the decision to just unfriend the people who posted it, take himself out of the conversation.
Now, really, the question here is, how can you tell the difference between a conversation that is productive and candid and a conversation that's just become a kind of graffiti wall?
Well, absolutely. And I think this sort of goes to the question of where Facebook fits into this sort of conversation in general. Sometimes this is an unwelcome surprise. We don't always talk about race to our family members or people we see every day, right? And so it sort of comes out as a shock that Auntie Edna feels this way and you have to see her next week at family dinner, right? And so for many people also, the fact that these conversations are not happening face-to-face, it changes the dynamic. It gives them sort of a freedom to maybe be crasser. And here's another way that Ibrahim puts it.
You look for something witty or you want to say something brilliant or smart. You want to say something cutting or the right thing. But then what ends up happening on Facebook is that you just like vomit, right? It's unedited, emotional barrage. And, you know, spiritual people will tell you when you're about to get into an argument, that's when you should stop talking. That's when you should sit down and stop screaming and collect your thoughts and collect your breath. But Facebook gives you the space to just let it out.
Do psychologists say that what you keep in is actually the truth, or what you keep in an emotional moment or let out in the case of Facebook is not the truth? It's some distortion of reality.
The truth is hard to get to, John, but I did talk to Shannon Rao. She's a social psychologist at Benedictine University, and she did a study into how people respond to racist messages on Facebook by sending different messages from a fake white man to a group of white Facebook users. And frequent Facebook users largely disagreed with an overt racist message that said whites are the supreme race. So yay, phew, right? But they didn't disagree with a less obviously racist message, one that said whites are the most repressed group in America today. Here's Shannon Rao.
They will kind of reject very extreme messages, but when messages are kind of more subtle and are more in line with what they would already agree with, they can be pretty powerful. That those messages are out there, and even if they have kind of a racist component to it, if it helps kind of give fuel to their original existing attitudes, that they can be very influential.
Of course, the FBI has discovered this, you know, over decades. I mean, when you say, hey, let's join our own Nazi party, folks, everyone goes, there's obviously a cop online here. But when you try to subtly sort of tug at the heartstrings of people, then maybe they do come along. I mean, this isn't an organized, you know, white supremacist operation. These are just people who are digital pedestrians.
Right. And so we wanted to talk to people on the ground, particularly in St. Louis, where this is really sort of the epicenter of these sort of heated discussions. And I talked to a social service worker with the National Conference for Community and Justice. He's in St. Louis. His name is DeWitt Campbell. And he told me that finding and affirming common ground is the only way to move these discussions, these debates forward. And that the beauty of social media is that you can take a break. You can walk away. You can calm down, unlike at the family dinner table. So don't respond immediately online and really listen. And that's what Ibrahim is trying to do, too. He says he's proud of the diversity in his life and he doesn't want to sacrifice those relationships.
Well, but how do you back off from something? If you were to say, I mean, that's really why people should tune into your podcast to get an answer to the question, how do you back off if I said something?
I think it's saying, like, I hear you. I hear, just pretend they say that that person is the most important person in your life. You truly respect them and find one little kernel that you overlap with, that you find common ground with. And then take a deep breath and take it from there.
Keep the conversation going.
Right.
Manush Zomorodi is the host of the podcast New Tech City. A great listen for anyone who wants to get a handle on moral issues around science and technology. Subscribe to New Tech City on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks, Manush.
Thanks, John.
If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.